From Birmingham, Alabama, this is ARC Stories Radio. The stories you're about to hear are true, personal, and told by the people who live them in front of a live audience at one of our ARC Stories events.
And she says, would you pick up a pregnancy test on your way home from work? And I said, for whom?
I'm Taylor Robinson, and today we have four stories that will make you laugh, will make you cry, and perhaps even both at the same time.
The next thing I hear him say is, hey, here, come here, ride me like a bucking bronco.
We created ARC Stories to give Birmingham a place to tell its stories to the world.
On television came this news flash. 60 Street Baptist Church had been bombed. What? And I was gonna be there?
So coming up after the news, Birmingham's own true stories. Welcome to ARC Stories Radio. I'm Taylor Robinson, ARC Stories Director, and I'm joined by my co-host and story coach, Chris Kinsley.
Today we have four stories, each recorded at an ARC Stories event right here in Birmingham. They include one about a woman who risked her own dignity to get a chance at love, another about a guy raging against his own social awkwardness, and a story about becoming a father to three children in only 6 months.
Besides providing our own platform for people to tell their stories, one of our goals at ARC Stories is to partner together with other groups and organizations to help them tell their stories. Earlier this year, we were honored to get the opportunity to partner with the Civil Rights Institute and produce an event together. Our first story comes from that event. It was recorded at the Red Mountain Theater Cabaret. The theme was Marching On, stories about growing up in the Civil Rights era. Here's storyteller Ricky Powell.
In the 1960s, I was a 10th grader at Samuel Lohman High School. I lived on what some people will remember as Dynamite Hill. Friday morning, the 13th of September, 1963, uneventful, fortunately, was a day typical. Things went on as normal. And Friday evening, as we got on the bus going back, my friend Cynthia Wesley said, well, we'll talk over the weekend. And so I was cool with that. We rode the bus home, got on home. Saturday, typical, as you know, doing chores around the house. And so finally I decided I was gonna call a friend, my road dog, Cynthia Wesley. And as I called her, she didn't really want to talk to me, but that was very strange because we talked about everything. I could talk to her and ask her about girls, and she in turn would ask me about boys. I mean, as limited as that was about me, I didn't know nothing about no boys. All I knew about was me. But I tried to tell her what I knew. And so she then invited me to go to church with her the following morning, which was September the 15th, 1963, a gray, overcast morning. And so I was on the phone with her that Saturday night. And so here I was. Yeah, I'm sure I can go with you. My mother was sitting right close to me. What time do you want me to be ready? Okay, I can do that, I can do that. No problem. Oh no, I don't have to ask. Okay. Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'll talk to you then. Some mother, when I got off the phone, said to me, I need you to go with me to a funeral because, you know, times are very, very tense and people are not doing like they need to do or should do. And I don't want to be out stranded somewhere and if something happens, I don't have any help and maybe you can get away and run and get me some help. It was a very strange and tedious time because at that time, white men were dirty. They would do a lot of dirty things, and I could not understand, as a little boy, 15 years old, how some of these men who were the men who made decisions for a city, the ones who made all the plans for the city, could implement things that could be so ugly to children. So I couldn't go. But anyway, Sunday morning, around 10:15, 10:17, 10:21, this gargantuan blast shook our house. Now, as I said, as I started out, I lived on Dynamite Hill, which is from 16th Street Baptist Church, 16 blocks west. Then when you get to Center Street, you go up to 13th Avenue, and that's another 12 blocks. Well, my house shook like it was toilet paper. It was the blast was so strong, and I live in a brick house, and it's so strong that it just shook our house. Well, we thought, as always, trying to think the best, that maybe it was East Thomas Foundry, Fairfield Foundry blasting for ore so they can make steel. I mean, I know you all realize, some of you anyway, that we used to be the steel manufacturers of the world because we had all five of the elements needed to make steel. I knew that in the fifth grade. My teacher taught me that, so, you know, hey, I had some education. But anyway, the blast went off. It shook. Wow, that's a big blast. Well, I don't know how many of y'all realize this. Now, this may be a shock to you. Back in the 1960s, Birmingham, Alabama, and even the state of Alabama, only had two channels, 13 and 6. Okay? So on television came this news flash. 16th Street Baptist had been bombed. 16th Street Baptist Church had been bombed. What? And I was going to be there? Oh, my God. And all of a sudden, they started doing this breaking news, and they had pictures, moving pictures of these people coming out of the side of the church. And I told my mom, I said, Mom, that's Carol Robinson they're bringing out under the cover on that gurney. And then he brought out some other people. Well, we couldn't find Cynthia. They couldn't find Cynthia all day long. They could not find Cynthia. Where is Cynthia? Finally, Mr. Marshall, who was one of the members of 16th Street Baptist Church, was going down through the church, pulling back rubble, trying to find his children, who were also a part of the children's program that they were having at that church that morning. And as he did that, Cynthia Wesley's head rolled into his hands. My dear friend had been decapitated. Wow. What is this? I'd never really known a childhood friend to die, not even from asthma or whatever childhood illnesses or anything, but to be killed because she was in church that Sunday morning. So the day went on, and there was news because I lost two other friends. One was Carol Robinson. The other was Denise McNair. Denise McNair, I understand, had a piece of cinder block in her head like that. It was standing out like a horn. Carol Robinson, they didn't really describe how she looked in death, but it must have been something terrible because she was dead. And the sad story that I remember during that period of time was Addie and Judy Collins. That Sunday morning, they were skipping and dancing and having a good time on their way to church to serve the Lord. In spite of all the problems that we were having in Birmingham, the state of Alabama, and the United States, these little girls were enjoying themselves. And little did they know that it would be their last chance to romp and play. The saddest part about Addie Collins' recognition was the little girl who had been playing with her, Junie, was the one who had to identify her. And even today, she still has not gotten over the shock. And I'm almost certain that I would not have been able to get over it either, because it had to be devastating. Here one minute you're playing, and here the next moment you're gone. There were many times during the course of these years that I have existed that I have wondered, what would my friend have become had she lived? Would she have been president of NBC in New York? Would she have been a teacher extraordinary? I mean, I did okay. I got a chance to perform on Broadway. I got a chance to travel all around the world and perform. And she was smarter than me, so I'm sure she would have gone farther. But the sadness is, I never knew. The sadness was, I didn't have any closure, because I didn't ever get a chance to see her with a closed casket. But in spite of it all, our trip must continue, and we must be strong and diligent to make sure that those kind of things don't happen to us again. Not that we do it to ourselves. Now, countries outside of America, they might do anything, just like they did 9/11. But all of us who live in the same country, we don't need to do that no more. We need to try to get along. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe that we shall overcome someday.
Ricky Powell is a Broadway and jazz vocalist and an inductee of the Alabama Jazz Hall of Fame.
The bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church was obviously not only a monumental event in the life of our city, but also in the civil rights movement as a whole. In fact, events like that are so tragic and momentous that we sometimes forget to treat them as real events that happen to real people. They just become history. But Mr. Powell not only brings us back to reality, he also helps us to see our own role, that we can still be a part of helping Birmingham and even our own country overcome all the injustices of our past. Our next story also involves something very common to many of us, but is pursued in a rather extraordinary way. It's all about the lengths to which some of us will go for a chance at love. That's coming up in just a moment on ARC Stories Radio. Birmingham's own true stories. This is ARC Stories Radio. We're bringing you true personal stories told live in front of an audience right here in Birmingham by the people who live them. I'm story coach Chris Kinsley.
And I'm Taylor Robinson, the director of ARC Stories. Now, everyone wants to be loved, but far too many of us just sit around and wait for love to find us. But what would happen if we actually took it upon ourselves to try to make love happen? Our next storyteller discovers the answer to that question for herself. This recording was from the second event we ever held. It was at Second Row Studio right here in Birmingham, and the theme for the night was Love is a Battlefield, stories about love and heartache. Here's storyteller Amy Marchineau.
Okay. So I was living in Dallas, and I was 30 years old, and I was single, and I was tired of being single. And so a friend of mine, April, called me up and was like, come to Birmingham for the weekend. Come hang out. I was like, okay, I will. So we planned it, and I came to Birmingham for the weekend. And before we went to go hang out with our buddies, she said to me, hey, I want you to be really, I think, she didn't say I want, well, she probably did, but I think you should get to know and be intentional about getting to know this guy named Alan. Now, I knew Alan. We had gone to college together, but I didn't know him well. And we had hung out after college, sort of. And I knew he was funny and irreverent, which was great, but that's all I knew. It's really all I needed to know, you know? Okay. So, all right. So, she says, I think you need to get intentional about getting to know him. I was like, okay, I do relationships. I mean, you know, I get that. I can be intentional. Let's roll. 120%. I'm ready. So we go to this, we hung out at a friend's house for the weekend, and so we go and they had like a barbecue that night, and I got to see a bunch of people I hadn't seen in a really long time, and that was great. But I was on. I was like, where's Alan? Great, there he is. I'm gonna go stand by him. Oh look, there's nobody talking to him. Great, I'm gonna go talk to him. I was getting to know Alan. Well, Alan and I both share a passion and love for the musical Annie. And we decided it would be very constructive and beneficial to rewrite the words to the song It's a Hard Knock Life, make it It's a Hard Knocker's Life. I don't know where those lyrics are, but they were really good. They were really good. So we spent, I mean, like, people went to bed while we were working on this, and we were serious about it, and we rhymed. I mean, it was good. Man, I wish I had those. Okay, so I was intentional about getting to know Alan, so I was writing an irreverent song with him. It's what you do when you're trying to be, you know, intentional. So we wrote the song, It's a Hard Knocker's Life, and we go to bed. And next day comes, we're going to hang out at the pool. All right, let's roll. I'm being intentional. Sat next to Alan, had conversation. What do you like on your pizza? You know, deep things like that. What I remember he asked me, what kind of food did your mom fix you that you really liked? You know, just really great conversation stuff like that. And then we were in the pool and we're playing and he's irreverent and funny, remember? And so we're playing and we're having fun. And the next thing I hear him say is, hey, here, come here, ride me like a bucking bronco. In the pool, and there were people on the side of the pool who were in on this situation, and I was making eye contact like, this is shameless. Like, what am I doing? Oh, okay. Thankfully, that was the low point for intentionality at that point. So we're get through that. And we all decide to go see a movie. So we went to go see Finding Nemo, and I got to sit by Alan. Now, keep in mind that from Friday night through Finding Nemo at this point, I was gung-ho 120%. About getting ready for the movie, I was like, Amy, you are not going to walk away from here engaged. Like, rein it in, Bronco. Because that's how I am. I'm like 0 to 100, okay, he's going to propose by the end of the night. So I had to, like, rein it in. Maybe I'll come back, we'll go to O'Charlie's, and we'll start there. So I talked myself off the ledge, and we get in, and I'm like, awesome, I'm cool, I'm easy, I'm breezy, I'm getting to sit by Alan. Of course, internally, I'm like, but outside, I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll sit by Alan. So we got to sit by each other. Okay, now, I didn't know this, but at the time, I found out later that he really, the movie starts, we're watching it, and during the movie, I found out that Alan wanted to hold my hand. I didn't know that. And he wanted to hold my hand so much that he had it out on the thing, on the armrest like this, hoping that I would grab it. Well, I'd already ridden him like a bucking bronco. I mean, how easy does he think I am? Is that gonna have to be stricken? Okay. So I find that out later, and I'm like, oh, what, I would have, but no, because, okay. So we get home, and we're not spending the night that night. We're all packing up our stuff, and I'm, at this point now, I'm Debbie Downer. Like, I am like, oh, I'm never going to find anybody, and I start talking to God, and I'm like, I really don't want to talk about pizza, and, you know, I want to have a real conversation with him. I'm really deep, and I have a lot I'd love to talk about with someone, and Lord, please, just, I'd love to have a conversation. And God was like, well, you can do that over the phone. Like, calm down. So I was like, all right, I get it. So I go back, I've got my bags packed, and we're ready to go. And Alan, instead of having his bag packed, is standing in the kitchen in this house with a plate and a piece of cake on it. And he says, instead of goodbye, like we're all kind of saying our goodbyes, he's like, I'm going to go outside and eat this cake and look at the pool. And I'm like, we were in the pool all day. Remember? How do you forget that? Well, of course, I'm like, really? You're going to go out to the pool, huh? You know, me, didn't listen to the Lord, and I was like, I got this. So I decide you're going out to eat cake by the pool. I know what that means. So I go out there. I didn't know what it meant, but I was like, one more chance, please. So I go out there, and luckily, he starts a conversation about his sister and her wedding, and that this happened in July and her wedding happened in April, and so it was still pretty fresh. And so he was like, man, I just loved my sister's wedding, and it was such an opportunity to see family and friends coming together and celebrating community and celebrating them. And he said, I can't wait for that to happen for me. I just really can't wait. And he said, you know, I've got about 80% of everything I need. I've got family, I've got friends, I'm good. But there's that 20%. There's just that 20% that's missing. And it's a small, seems small, but it's a really big, important part. And it's 20%, and it's just missing for me. And I thought, I'm sure I said, wow, that's well put, you know? Yeah, I get it. I feel the same way. Okay. So, but I was really centered, and I wasn't weird or over the top about it. I was like, cool. And so, we got ready to go, and we said our goodbyes, and he went to hug me. I don't like side hugs. I think they're a form of weakness. It is. Don't like them. Non-committed tells you a lot. Tells you a lot. Don't get nervous if you side hug me, and I can call you out. But I just don't like them. And Alan is a side hugger, okay? I know that about him. He front hugged me. He front hugged me out by the pool. Whole thing. And as he was hugging me, he said, you know, I feel like 100% with you. Now, I'm not good at math. Excited to be 20%. So we started dating, and 2 years later we got married, and my bucking bronco's right there.
Amy Marchioneau teaches high school English and theater, and she and her husband, Alan, have been married for 10 years and are the proud parents of 2 sons.
I think we all not only want love, but also know what it's like to do some pretty embarrassing things in a desperate attempt to find it. Parts of this story sound like they could be straight out of a middle schooler's diary.
Yeah.
But I love that Amy and Alan were in their 30s when it happened.
My favorite part is when he wants to talk to her, but instead of asking, he casually mentions he's going to go look at the pool. There's probably no other couple in history that can say that was the line that made it happen. I just want to say, you're an adult. Man up.
We can't all be so suave and smooth all the time. And in fact, that basically sums up the entire life outlook of our next storyteller. From an event we hosted at Urban Standard with the theme of fish out of water, stories from outside the comfort zone, here's storyteller Steve Glenn.
All right, I am a guy who hates attention. And I realize that standing on a stage in front of 110 strangers is not exactly the best way to avoid attention. But despite all this, I'm a guy who hates attention. I don't like attention being called to me. I don't like meeting new people. I hope not to talk to any of you after this. And I live a cursed life because looking like this is not a great way to avoid attention, and God thinks he's freaking hilarious. And so he cursed me with a disease where my little pores can't hold hair follicles, bless their hearts. And so people are always asking me if I have cancer or how I shave my head so clean or whatever, and it sucks. And I have to say, no, can't, just very ugly and, you know, weird looking. So it's just, please quit talking to me. So anyway, I don't like it. So this story is about a time when I had a lot of negative attention. I'm a school teacher, like Taylor said, and so in the summers, when I'm chilling hard, there are certain things that I do for the family. You know, my wife is like most of you poor people who work like all year. So I do certain things during the summer to sort of lift the burden off of her. And one of the things that I always do in the summer is I go to the store, because no one likes going to the store. There's tons of people there, first of all. It's insanely expensive. And, you know, people talk to you. Your cashier constantly talks to you about your groceries, which is just the worst. You know, oh, I like these. All right. Asking you, you know, oh, push pins, making a craft? Please don't. Just ding, 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 ding. $200 is your total. Let me pay and leave. Anyway, so I go to the store, despite hating it, to lift the burden off of my lovely wife during the summer. And so one particular extremely hot July day in the summer of 2011, I think it was July, I had gone to the store, to Walmart in Pelham, and when I go to the store, I stock up, because I don't want to have to go back next week. It's the worst. So I buy lots of groceries when I go. And that day and time, we were drinking a lot of cans of Coke and Diet Coke in our house. So that's one thing that I bought, you know, 5, 6, 7, 12 packs of. You don't want to run out of that, because that necessitates another store trip. It's a nightmare, and the cashier and the whole bit. So anyway, this one day I went to the store in July. It's blazing hot outside. There's probably a baseball game on at home I wanted to be watching, but I'm doing it. The cashier asked me if I was a swimmer, and no, not again. Just ugly. So anyway, it was this miserable store run, and I get out to my car, pushing my buggy, you know, $200 friggin' dollars for groceries, and I load all the groceries into the back of my car. And so my next point is that I friggin' hate my car. I'm a guy who, I did a lot of my growing up on a farm. I want to work with my hands and split wood in the winter, and I want to drive a truck. Okay, that's just who I am. That's, you know, part of, I learned to drive in a truck on the farm. So I want to drive a truck, but when my last car died, we went to the dealership, and the right thing to do at the time for my family was for me to not buy a truck. We couldn't afford it. We didn't want to take on a car payment. So here's a car we can pay cash for, pretty low mileage. It's a 2-door Ford Focus hatchback. Not a truck. Just so far on the other end of the spectrum from truck. So I hate this thing. And so this day, I take the groceries out to the car. I lift the stupid hatchback, and I put all the groceries in there. I walk around to my driver's side door to get in, because this nightmare of going to the store is over. Side note, in that day, I could get in my driver's side door. An accident has happened since then, and I now crawl in the passenger side and hop across. True story. But anyway, I get in my door, and I'm going home. Okay, this is over. I'll catch the end of the game. Good stuff. So I get on the Highway 31. By this time, it's 5:15. Rush hour is hitting. There are 1,500 cars on Highway 31. And I go up the hill towards Valleydale, and I turn to go down towards my house. And where I turned onto that little spur of Lorna Road, there's a dip, and then it goes back up. And so I turn left, and I hit the dip, and there's an enormous amount of noise 6 feet behind me or so. And I look in my rearview mirror, and the hatchback that I never wanted in the first place has popped open. And all of my $200 worth of groceries have spilled out onto the road, and they're now cascading down the hill onto 31. And I'm looking in my rearview mirror at the carnage, and for a second, I have a decision to make. First instinct, gas it. Get the hell out of here. None of these people will be able to look at you. But if I do that, I got to go back to the store tomorrow. Terrible. So I decided in that instant, all right, this sucks. I'm going to pull over. I'm going to get my groceries off the road, see what's salvageable, and go on home. So I pulled over at the top of the hill, looked down, 1,000 cars behind my groceries. No one wanted to run over them. There are 50 cans of Coke and Diet Coke in the road. Some salvageable, some not. Some were laid to waste there on Lorna Road. And I took just the long, I guess I was hurrying, but just a walk of shame down the hill. People were staring, horns were honking 6 or 7 cars back, like that's going to do any good. And I start clearing my groceries off the road. Very sorry. I know you're all looking at me. So much attention. And I start clearing my groceries off the road. The main thing that got destroyed were the Cokes and the Diet Cokes. And so I'm gathering them all up. The fridge pack boxes had busted open so easily. And I'm gathering what can be gathered and moving it. And some cars start to kind of trickle by, going around into the other lane when they can. And, I'm drenched with Coke and Diet Coke. And some of them had those tiny little holes in them. So there were little Coke geysers just blasting me in the face. It sucked a lot. And I'm clearing these off, and I've got arms full of Coke and Diet Coke. Very sorry. 6 or 7 cars come by, and then up pulls, swear to God, a gigantic F-350, it must have been. Bright red, huge tires, probably a pretty big lift kit, dual quad exhaust, whatever you do to trucks. And that's my truck. That's the truck I wanted to drive. And my hatchback's at the top of the hill, broken. And this guy pulls up in the truck, and I'm not sure if he came to a complete stop, but it felt like it lasted a long time. And he pulls up in my truck that I wanted to buy, and he rolls down his passenger window, and he said, "Hey, man," Coke's just shooting me in the face, looked up. He said, "Hey, man, you suck." And so I can react two ways, right? First, Anthony's going, "No, you're the one who sucks. That's you." But instead, you know, he was right in that moment. I did suck. And so my response was, "I know." Very sorry. You know, that was a terrible day because I'm a guy who hates attention.
Steve Glenn is a true man of mystery, yeah. Even to his closest friends. He periodically provides random musings on Twitter at Thoughts on Smart.
A little background. Now, we actually had a storyteller drop out the afternoon of that event, and I was desperate to fill the slot. So I called Steve because I know for a fact that he has so many examples in his life of what it feels like to be a fish out of water. He took some convincing, but then he showed up and killed it.
It's a great example of what I think is one of our guiding principles at ARC Stories. Everyone has great stories, and anyone can tell a great story. In fact, our next story is also from a first-time storyteller who finds himself in way, way over his head. We'll have that one in just a minute. This is ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own true stories. Thanks for joining us for ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's true stories told by the people who lived them and recorded in front of a live audience. I'm story coach Chris Kinsley.
And I'm the director of ARC Stories, Taylor Robinson. One of the great joys of my life has been becoming a father. However, at the same time, one of the most overwhelming experiences of my life was also becoming a father. For most of us, though, we get at least 9 months to prepare. But that's not the case in this next story. It was recorded at an event we hosted at Second Row Studios, where the theme was All In, Tales of Taking the Leap. Here's storyteller Shane Etheridge.
Before we got married, my wife and I had these discussions, as you do, about what we wanted our family to look like when it, you know, came time to reach that point in our lives together. How were we going to put that together, and what that new like family unit was going to look like? And we both knew that we wanted adoption to be a part of that, to take a kid with no family and bring him into a family. That was always going to be part of our story, and we both wanted to do that. So after we've been married a couple of years, we got the opportunity to go and visit the Eastern European nation of Ukraine. We go to this country, and we drive all over it, and we go to several different orphanages in several different cities and meet tons of kids, and this is definitely where we're going to, you know, adopt from. And Brandy would probably tell you that she felt a pull towards Ukraine, a calling for Ukraine. To me, honestly, Ukraine was just as good a place as any to snag a kid from. And so we go, not that they just snag them. So we go and we do this thing, and we go all over this foreign country, and we meet all these kids, and it was great. It was a really great trip. And so we got back on the plane to come home, and I said, this was an awesome trip. Let's never come back here. Until it's time to adopt, and, you know, we're good. I'm good on Ukraine. I'm good. And so she did not feel that way. So when the opportunity arose to go back the next year, she went back. I did not go because I was done on Ukraine. And so she went back to a city on the extreme eastern border, like I said before, very near Russia. And she worked this time with one orphanage and got to know those kids. Now, when she left, I said, find a kid, we'll go. You know, pick us one out. Like going to Target. And so I said, Pio, pick out a kid and we'll go. I got two rules. Nothing over about the age of 7 or 8, because once you get past that, you run into some issues and they're further behind in, you know, school and things like that. And no girls. I don't want girls. I don't want daughters. Girls are crazy half the time. And the other half the time, I don't understand them. And then they want to date boys. And then boys want to date them right back. And I know this because I'm a boy. And when I wanted to date the hell out of girls. And so she goes. And she's gone for, you know, 10 days or 2 weeks. And then she comes back with these stories about these two just wonderful little kids, and she, I just loved them, and they were awesome. And I said, what are their names? And she said, Sasha and Marina. And I said, sounds like girl names. And she said, yeah, they're girls, but it's, you know, it's not an issue because they're not adoptable. You can't adopt these two. They have parents or a grandparent that still has rights. Ukraine also has this weird sort of revolving / open door policy with orphanages in which you can kind of just take your kid and leave them. Sometimes it's we'd rather be drunk all the time than raise these kids. A lot of times it's we're out of food and we can't feed them, so we'll be back to get them when there's more food. And so kids kind of come and go as there's a lot of kids in Ukrainian orphanages aren't actually orphans. So she goes and she comes back with these stories of these two little girls who she is head over heels in love with but are staying there. And so it's moot, right? So she goes back the next year, and she comes back with the same kind of stories about the same two kids. And then she goes back again the next year, and she comes back with the same stories about the same two kids. And then she goes back again the next year, and then I get a phone call. And I remember the date because it was Halloween, and it was odd for her to call me because she's in Ukraine, and it costs like $11 a minute to make a phone call from there. And so I pick up the phone at work and said, hey, how much is this phone call costing us? And she said, I know, right? Probably a lot. And she said, I got to tell you something. And I said, what? Is everything okay? And she said, yeah, I just have to tell you something. I just found out that Sasha and Marina are available for adoption. And I can hear in her voice, she is telling me this because she feels like she has to, because she's doing her due diligence. She's doing right by these kids by just telling me that this is open. This door is open. And she knows what I'm going to say is, Sasha and Marina, by the way, are at this point almost 13 and 10. And so she knows I'm going to say it's a 13-year-old girl. We are not equipped for that. We are, you know, it's our first foray into parenthood, and I'm not sure if a 13 and a 10-year-old are an awesome way to get the ball rolling on that. Plus, it's two of them, and that's twice as expensive. Adoption is extremely expensive. And so she knows I'm going to say this, and so she tells me they're adoptable, and I say, what changed? Did the parents die or something like that? She said, no, we were just given bad information. And so I said, well, tell them we're coming to get them. And there was a long pause that cost me about $6. and she said, what? Like that? And I said, tell them we're coming to get them. And she said, are you serious right now? And I said, yeah, tell them we're coming to get them. And she said, but you said no girls. You know, and I said, I know what I said, but for these two, for you, it's different. You love them. They love you. You're already their mom here. And so tell them we're coming to get them. And she said, are you sure about this right now? And I said, yeah. She said, do you want to sleep on it or something? You know, and I said, no, it's all thought out. Just tell them we're coming to get them. And she just went, I'm going to call you back tomorrow. And I said, you're going to call me back tomorrow. You know what I'm going to tell you? I'm going to tell you to tell them we're coming to get them. And she said, just let me call you back tomorrow. It'll make me feel better. And I said, fine, call me back tomorrow. She calls me back tomorrow. I said, where you at? And I said, tell them we're coming to get them. And so she did. And she comes home, and we start the adoption process, which is, in the best of cases, a nightmare. When you do it in a place as ass backwards as Ukraine, it's like going to the monkey house and trying to teach math. It's and so we start the paperwork process, and we hit this paperwork like a two-ton truck. There is a mountain of forms and applications to fill out, and it takes most people 9 months at least, and we did it in just under 6 because we were absolutely driven by the fact that every day we woke up in America and our daughters, who we knew and who were like a face and a handwriting and a personality and a voice and hobbies, they're real to us already. And so we wake up in America and they wake up in a building with no heat where the lock doesn't work on the door, and there's no way I can protect them, and there's no way I can provide for them, and somehow sending them a coat just doesn't cut it anymore. Yeah. And so we bombed through this paperwork. And while we're doing this, people just came out of the woodwork to help us. As I said before, adoption is extremely expensive. We had friends get together and put together a benefit for us to raise money, like a $20 a plate thing in silent auction. And at the end of it, it had raised like $5,000, which they handed to us in an envelope. Said, here you go, use it. We had a family offer to pay our in-country expenses when we were there, our translator, our facilitator, several thousand dollars. They just said, we feel like we should pay it for you. And we have friends who, out of the blue, called us one morning and said, we want to give you guys all of our Sky Miles to use, hundreds of thousands of Sky Miles that they were saving to do something with. You know, all these people just came and did all this phenomenal stuff. And when people do that, when people, you know, come to the line with you like that, it makes this big thing you're doing seem a lot less risky. And it makes the fact that it's going to change your life forever seem a lot less scary. So we get through the paperwork, and we submit it all, and we get a court date, and we go to Ukraine. Now, the time we spend in Ukraine is another arc light altogether. Just the cast of characters that was involved in this process would take the rest of our time. So it's a very long story, but it's a good story, and it ends happily. It ends with us tucking our daughters into bed their first night in America. And so it's a successful ending to that story. We've been back in America together, all of us, for 2 days, 48 hours. And I get a phone call, another one from my wife, and she says, would you pick up a pregnancy test on your way home from work? And I said, for whom? And she said, well, it's for me, but don't worry. I know that's not what this is. I can't shake this nausea. I can't shake this fatigue. And I feel like I should be feeling better by now. And I'm not. She was nauseous and fatigued the whole time we were in Ukraine, but so was I. Because we're in this foreign country, it's extremely stressful. We're going through this process in which you have to stand before judges that speak a language you don't. The food is terrible. Everything smells like beets and garbage. I was nauseous and exhausted too. It's just that she figured something else was off. So I said, yeah. You know, she said, I want to eliminate that as a possibility before I go to the doctor and ask for a B12 shot or antibiotics or something like that. And I said, okay, great, fine. I'll get you two pregnancy tests. And so I did, and I brought home, and I threw them on the bed, and I didn't really think anything about it until I was sitting in my floor watching the Braves play the Pirates on the television, and she brings me a pregnancy test with a big blue plus sign on it. And I just looked at it and started laughing. I mean, because hell, it's funny. And so I handed it back to her, and then I said, does this have pee on it? And she said, well, yeah. And I said, well, you take it away then and go to the other one. And so she did, and it had the same result as you might expect. And then I called my sister-in-law, who's a nurse, and said, pregnancy tests. She said, yeah. I said, false positives. And she said, they don't exist. What year do you think this is? And I said, that like ever, they don't happen. And she said, who's pregnant? And I said, right. The thing says Brandy's pregnant, but that's what I'm calling you. And she said, okay, every one in a billion pregnancy tests will tell you that you're not pregnant when you are. And that's usually because you did something wrong and messed it up. If one's saying that you're pregnant, then unless Brandy's having hormone replacement therapy to become a man, you need to make a doctor's appointment. And so we did. And when something like this happens, you think back, you know, and when you don't expect this to happen, you think back and you try to pinpoint exactly when things went south, as it were. And so we did, and we thought we had, we pinpointed it to 6 weeks ago. Okay, 6 weeks before. And so we looked it up on the little guide that women use that compare their unborn children to like fruits and vegetables. That seems to be the standard. And so the thing says, your unborn child is about the size of a sweet pea right now, and you should see a flashing little light where the heartbeat is and blah, blah, blah. And so we go in and they said, you know, you say you're pregnant, and I guess, and how far along do you think you are? 6 weeks, okay, cool. So she pops the thing on her stomach, and I mean, up on the screen pops a baby. Not a sweet pea, but a baby with a head and arms and hands and legs and feet. Clearly identifiable as a human person. And I looked back at Brandy and said, Brandy, that does not look like a sweet pea. And she said, and I looked back at the nurse and said, how old is that baby? And she was drawing a little line across it. She said, I'm going to put that baby at 13 weeks. So to save you some math, 13 weeks is 3 months and some change. So we are now, she was pregnant the whole time while we were in Ukraine. She is through the first trimester with no prior knowledge of being pregnant at all. And that means it's July, late July, and in January, we're gonna have a baby. So here we go. And so 6 months later, she did have a baby, which I'm pleased and proud to say was both under the age of 7 and not a girl. So a few weeks ago, we're all in the backyard. Marina, the youngest daughter, was helping me pot a maple tree that we're trying to get to grow. She kind of out of the blue and out of the quiet said, Papa, are you happy? That's what they call me. She said, Papa, are you happy that you adopted us? And I said, yeah, I am. I'm happy about it every single day. You guys are the best thing I ever did. So risk paid off. Thanks.
Daddy sang bass. Mama sang tenor. Shane Etheridge is a graphic designer and co-owner of Upper Air Creative. In fact, they do all of our graphic design for ARC Stories. You can check them out on Twitter, @UpperAir.
To me, the most powerful moment in Shane's story is when he simply says to his wife, tell them we're coming to get them. He didn't have to help those girls. He never met them. Yet he decides in that moment that they are his daughters. And it's in that moment when his story goes from good to great.
Absolutely. And everybody has stories like that. Just a series of moments and decisions that completely change the course of our lives. In fact, sometimes those stories begin when we're very young. And we'll have a few like that at our next event coming up in just a few weeks on September 12th. The theme is Back to School, Stories from Around the Classroom. And we'd love to have you join us as part of our audience. You can get all the details on our website, arcstories.com.
Thanks for listening to ARC Stories Radio. This program is produced by ARC Stories in partnership with WBHM. We especially need to thank Michael Crowell, Program Director at WBHM, as well as Audrey Atkins, Marketing Manager, Will Dahlberg, Membership Manager, and Rachel Lindley, News Director. The General Manager for WBHM is Scott Hamley. Recording and mastering was by Eric Chapman from Symmetric Sound. Upper Air Creative does all of our design, and Territory 3 provides our website. Special thanks to Aaron Moon and Nate Dreger for making this episode possible. If you like today's stories, please subscribe to our podcast. You can find it on iTunes, SoundCloud, or on our website, arcstories.com. There you can listen to other stories, you can stay up to date with all of our events, and even submit your own story. After all, we are always asking, what's your story?